Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie.
I'm with Salman Rushdie, a writer whose work has taken him into some very difficult territory, both in fiction and in his own life. He has a new novel out in September, The Golden House, set in the America of Obama and Trump. And now BBC Radio 4 is broadcasting a major new dramatisation of his second novel, Midnight's Children, which went on to win the Booker Prize in 1981 and was later voted the Booker of Bookers. Midnight's Children takes as its inspiration the moment of India's birth as an independent nation, and its protagonist, Salim Sanai, is born on the stroke of midnight, at exactly the moment of partition, on the 15th of August, 1947. Salim's life proves to be a mirror to the troubled story of his country. The displacements, the divisions, the wars, but also the mysticism, the magic, and the idealism.
Salim, Salim, are you there?
On the 15th of August, between midnight and 1 a.m., 1,001 children were born in India, every one of them with miraculous talents. And I, Salim Sanai, was able to communicate with them all.
I can multiply fish.
Wow!
I can turn into a boy or a girl.
But two of us, born on the stroke of midnight, were given the greatest powers. I, who could see into the hearts of people, and Shiva, the great warrior.
Salman, this year marks both the 70th anniversary of partition, but also your own 70th birthday.
Yeah, I'm older. 8 weeks to the day older, yeah. But yes, I mean, it's quite a landmark.
Was that coincidence of timing one of the impulses for writing the novel in the first place?
Well, you know, the truth is that when I first thought about the book, I had just thought that I wanted to write a novel about childhood and that I would use my own memories of growing up in Bombay as the material for that, you know, and I had no larger plan than that. And then at a certain point, when thinking about my own childhood and realizing that there was this close proximity of my birth to Independence Day, I just thought to myself, what would it be like if that 8 week gap were not there, if it was actually the same day? And the moment I thought that, the entire book changed completely, you know, because clearly sort of history rushed into it. And it became clear that if these two entities, the boy and the country, in fact, two boys and the country, were all contemporaneous in their moment of birth, then the novel had to tell the story of all three of them, which included the story of the country. I remember feeling very excited about the idea and also feeling extremely scared of my ability to pull it off. And so I realized that I'd thought of something very large and it might have been too big for me to chew. You know? And it took me 5 years to do it, that's why.
We should also say it's not just a story about partition, because the novel follows the lives of three generations of Salim Sanai's family from 1915 to the late 1970s.
It's roughly speaking 30 years before and 30 years after the moment of independence, I mean, roughly speaking. So it's a 60-year span, which is, I mean, colossally ambitious. I don't know how I had the gumption to do it.
The ambition of youth, I suppose.
I think that's exactly what it is. I think if I was to think about it now, I'd be too scared to do it.
One of the key plot points is that there are two babies, both born at midnight, who are swapped at birth. So Salim, who is really the son of two poor street entertainers, is swapped with the son of a well-to-do, middle-class Bombay family. That exchange has quite a fairy tale, mythical notion.
It's a sort of deliberately almost Bollywood, deliberately melodramatic operatic device, because that seemed to be part of the atmosphere that the book has tried to create. I mean, it's kind of a corny device, but then most opera is based on corny devices, you know, and it's just a question of whether you can make it mean something. And as the book unfolded, I mean, as I was writing it, I kind of liked the parallelism of the poor boy who grows up in a rich family and the rich boy who grows up in a poor family. You know, it became helpful as a way of exploring the subject.
It seems to me that a lot of the novel is about chaos, about political and social chaos, but also about personal chaos, the chaos of family relations, of forbidden love, of illicit desire, of failed businesses, of failed dreams, of paths not taken. Does Salim, who's a slightly unreliable narrator, is he a way of organising that chaos while at the same time
reflecting it.
Yeah, I mean, Salim's, the sort of comic device of Salim's story is that he believes himself to be responsible for history. You know, he believes history is sort of his fault. And so everything that happens in the book, he takes personally. You know, he thinks it's in some way engendered by his own nature or his own being in the world, or it's because of him. And in a way, that crazy solipsism becomes like the glue that sticks everything together. And also what happens, I think, as you go through the story is that it becomes more both comically and tragically evident that he's really wrong. This idea that he is the master of his time is in a way sadly shown to be false as he becomes more and more the victim of it.
One of the presiding influences behind Midnight's Children and behind several of your other novels is that notion of Scheherazade and the Thousand and One Nights, and also the Indian oral tradition of storytelling. Were you consciously drawing on those traditions?
Storytelling, certainly. And I asked myself how to represent this colossal reality in a single book. And it seemed to me one of the most obvious things about India to anybody who goes there or lives there is its crowdedness, is its enormous multiplicity of humanity, you know, and how do you represent that, you know, on the page? And I thought a way of doing it is to deliberately overcrowd the narrative, you know, tell too many stories so that your main storyline in a way has to push its way through a crowd of other stories which are all around it.
That's been the pleasure of dramatizing it for radio in different length episodes, in fact, because that's been a way to both reflect that structure of the novel, but also that multi-facetedness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty radical, you know, to have a radio series where the episodes are all different lengths. I've never seen it done before, so I'm very happy to see that little moment of originality in the dramatization.
Might radio, in fact, be the perfect medium for the story of a boy who can receive voices like a radio?
Yes, yes. He refers to himself as a radio. He called All India Radio. You know, there's a chapter of the novel called that. All these children born and the hour of independence all have different kinds of supernatural gifts, and his gift is this kind of telepathic thing where he can assemble them all in the kind of radio station of his mind, you know, and allow them even, not just that he can hear them, but they can talk to each other. So, yeah, I mean, it's very appropriate, I think.
And that crowdedness you were talking about is also in the language of the novel. It's image-crammed, metaphor-rich. And there's also sprinkling of Urdu and Hindi.
A little sprinkling, yes. I was lucky enough when I was at Cambridge to meet E.M. Forster. We just overlapped. He was almost 90 and I was almost 20. And of course, I'm a very great admirer of Passage to India. But one of the things I thought about this book that I admire is that it didn't sound like the country that I knew. You know, that this very cool Forsterian prose, very classicist prose. It seemed to me India's not cool, you know, India's hot. It's hot and noisy and sensual and a kind of assault, really, on all the senses. And so, in a way, I thought, how can I invent a way of speaking which represents that, which is, in a way, the opposite of the Forsterian language? And so, in a way, bouncing off E.M. Forster and going in the opposite direction sort of helped me find this loud, crowded, noisy, vulgar language. I mean, one of the reasons it took me so long to write, to like 5 years and a bit, is that I was really learning how to write it while I was writing it, conquering all kinds of fears about inadequacy, you know, in order to try and find solutions.
And was it finding the voice of Salim that
that was no question. I mean, that was the thing. When I first started thinking about the book, I had not thought that it would be a first-person narrative. But every time I tried to write a passage that was a third-person passage, it was just oddly dead on the page. It was sort of inert on the page. And I got very worried because I thought I felt that there was a good story to tell, but I was somehow not telling it in a way that was alive. And so then I thought, let me just see what happens if I let him talk. And then, you know, once he started talking, it was quite clear I was never going to shut him up. So it was a very exciting voice to discover.
I wanted to talk a little bit about partition, which was obviously a huge trauma. Over 1 million people dead.
Yeah.
50 million people displaced. 70 years on, do you think we're still living with the aftershocks of that event?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like many people who came from an Indian Muslim family, I mean, my family was split right down the middle. You know, so roughly speaking, half my family ended up in what was then West Pakistan, and the other half, including my own parents, stayed in India. It kind of wrecked families, quite apart from the enormous massacres, you know. It had an enormously damaging effect on family life for millions of people. And then, you know, in those early days, I remember as a child, we would go back and forth between Bombay and Karachi and sometimes Rawalpindi, where we had relatives. And for a long time, the two countries didn't feel that different. You know, they felt much the same. But what happened is that they diverged and they became ignorant of each other because travel between the two became much more complicated and difficult. And so people grew up in Pakistan not really knowing anything about India except what government propaganda told them and vice versa. You know, people in India didn't know much about Pakistan except the somewhat harsh versions of Pakistan that were offered to them, particularly because there were all these wars between the two, you know. And so they really became very different. And I think that's still true at the political level anyway. There's still a lot of mistrust and hostility, and there's subjects like Kashmir which are unresolved. What I do think is that at the level of ordinary people, the people don't feel that division anymore. On the rare occasions, for example, when there have been sporting contests, there have been cricket matches between India and Pakistan, the crowds have been immensely friendly towards each other. So that's a small ground for optimism. But as against that, you know, what's happening in India now is with this present government, which is more overtly anti-secularist and is trying to, in a way, to turn India into exactly what the founding fathers did not want it to be, which was a Hindu nation, de-secularize it. In a strange and rather sad way, one is seeing India turn into Pakistan. There's an attempt to create a theocratic state, which will be an sort of opposite mirror of Pakistan. That worries me.
Could you have imagined that when you wrote the novel in 1981?
No. I remember when the book came out, those people who had critiques of it mainly critiqued the later part of it for being excessively pessimistic. You know, if I read it now, it seems ludicrously optimistic. What's happened in this period of time is that the country is... I could not conceivably have seen that this would happen in India. I never saw it coming.
I suppose it's a pattern we're seeing reflected all over the world.
Yes, the world is full of things that nobody saw coming, but here they are.